Okay, so we'll start from the top. Dear Ajahn, thank you for the marvelous teachings. Please explain Vibhava Tanha. Thank you, with metta. Okay, Vibhava Tanha. Tanha, of course, is craving or desire. Yeah, Tanha is the second noble truth, the origin of suffering. The origin of suffering is said to be craving. That's Tanha. And there's three kinds of tanha in the second noble truth. There is a kama tanha, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha. And kama tanha is a desire for the five sense world. Bhava tanha is desire for existence. And vibhava tanha is the opposite of bhava tanha. It's actually the desire not to exist. And it just means that maybe you had experiences in life which makes you understand that non-existence is, or feel that non-existence is preferable to existence. So you actually want to end existence. And sometimes that can happen by committing suicide. You want to try to end your existence by suicide. Or it can just be a kind of general desire that when you come to the end of your life, that you're hoping that you want to exist when you come to the end of your life. Either one of those would be a vibhava tanha. And so, but the problem with vibhava tanha, the reason why it is a kind of craving, yeah, is because the reason is because a craving is always about the future. Yeah, the craving is always about what we want the future to be like, is an idea of how we want things to be. And so it is a desire about the future state. Yeah, and because it is a desire about the future state, it still has to do with kind of projecting us into the future somehow. Tanha is always about projecting yourself into the future, some idea where you want to be in the future. And the same is true for vibhava tanha. The desired future state is a state of non-existence, if you like. I don't know if you can call it a state, but it is non-existence anyway. And this is quite different from the Buddhist path. The Buddhist path is about allowing things to cease. When you allow things to cease, there isn't any desire for a particular future state, or there's just the kind of the process of things coming to an end. So vibhava tanha is kind of a bit, you know, you have this desire to things to stop, but then it doesn't stop, because that very desire creates more life in the future, because you're projecting yourself into the future in a certain way. So that is the idea of vibhava tanha, non-existence. Dear Ajahn, what are your views on using plant medicine such as ayahuasca and mushrooms, known as psychedelic drugs? They have been used as treatment for addictions and also available for some who seek to enter deeper states of consciousness in some cultures. Yeah, so this is very interesting. There's a lot of psychedelic drugs, and there's lots of monastics, I don't know about the nuns, but certainly on the monk side, who have used these kind of psychedelic drugs before they became monastics. And I'm amazed at the kind of the amount of experience that some monastics have had in this area. It's kind of astonishing. Personally, I haven't really done, I never did much drugs before, so I don't really have much experience. But it certainly does sound interesting. And I think what it does, it opens up sometimes, it can do this anyway, it can open up the ideas about the world that, you know, you see the world in a new way. And it kind of opens up the possibility of perception of the world being very different from what we think it is. And for that reason, I think it led some of those people who became monastics later on, it kind of led them on, yeah, this kind of curiosity about what is possible. And of course, the problem with using drugs is that it is an experience that lasts only as long as the drug lasts. And then there's always the uncertainties when you use drugs about having bad experience and these kind of things. Of course, it's far preferable to do it on the spiritual path, because there's a sense of being able to repeat things. There's a development of wisdom. There's a very particular trajectory that you're on, that you're not on when you are using drugs. So I would never recommend people to use drugs to achieve these things. But at the same time, I don't think it is a terrible thing personally, because it is... these kind of drugs we're talking about here are not really addictive in the ordinary sense of the word, in the sense of some other drugs, and usually quite easy to stop using. That's my understanding anyway. So it is interesting. It can sometimes be a gateway to spiritual experience, depending on how you use it, depending on what your interest it is. If you just use it for entertainment, of course, it's going to be useless. But it can maybe sometimes be interesting in that sense. So I tend to be pretty liberal when it comes to these kind of things. I don't have any very kind of hardline views on these things. I think things like alcohol and other drugs are far more destructive than these hallucinogenic drugs can be. All right. Dear Ajahn, how does one get over the fear of pleasure in meditation? For some reason, my mind doesn't seem to fully accept that pleasure can be a good thing. Thank you. The fear of pleasure. How do you overcome the fear of pleasure? I don't know. I think you just have to try and gradually see that any kind of meditation that works is pleasurable to some extent. If you become peaceful, there is a degree of pleasure there, and presumably you are getting something out of your meditation. If you didn't get anything out of your meditation, presumably you wouldn't meditate, right? There must be some pleasure there already. So start looking for the pleasure that you already have, and then build on that. So there is to some extent probably you're not as fearful perhaps as you think. And then build it up gradually. Sometimes, I don't know exactly why people would be, maybe you think that the pleasure can be too powerful maybe. Maybe that's why you are afraid. Sometimes people who have had deep experiences of samadhi can have a bit of fear of those deep experiences because they are so overpowering. And it feels like you're losing your sense of self. Especially when you have to give up the doer inside, the sense of agency, because that is so dear to us, the sense of agency. We are the doers of our life, the creators of our fortune, and because that's how we see ourselves, the giving up of that can be quite scary even, anxiety producing. So just go very gently with yourself, just go slowly, start to see the good things that you already have, and I think you will eventually be able to accept the pleasures of meditation as well. And sometimes there can be very small pleasures, and gradually you grow it, you kind of allow it to develop and allow it to happen. Something like that. All right, I'm not sure exactly what else to say about that. All right, let's go to the next one. Dear Ajahn, this afternoon you mentioned the sutta on calming the mind. Could you please mention that sutta again? The sutta I mentioned this afternoon was maybe the Anapanasati sutta, perhaps, mindfulness of breathing sutta. I usually mention that quite a lot, and I think I mentioned it this afternoon as well. This is found in the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, number 118, mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati. It's all about calming the mind and calming it down. And we will look a little bit more at anapanasati towards the end of the retreat, because there is one sutta which has that at the beginning. Did I mention anything else that anyone can remember? That's the one I mentioned, right. Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes, the Vitakasantana Sutta. Yeah, that's the, that's found in the Majjhima Nikaya number 20, the 20th Sutta of the middle-length sayings. And that is all about the stilling of thought. So Vitakka is thought and Santana is like the stilling or calming of thoughts. And it gives five ways in how to still the thoughts, starting with the most obvious way and then taking it all the way to the most when you are really desperate kind of way at the very end. So that is a beautiful sutta, and I actually often read it out on these retreats because it is very useful for meditation practice, how to overcome especially bad kind of thoughts. So the Basically, the first one is about just what they call substitution sometimes. You have a bad thought and you kind of just look at the object in a different way and you substitute it and make it into a positive thought. So, for example, if you have some ill will towards a person, you look at that person in a different way and then you have compassion for them instead. Just a shift in perspective. Instead of thinking of the person as your tormentor, you think of them as a victim of their conditioning. And that kind of shift can happen like that. And you go from ill will to compassion, like almost like turning a switch in a sense, if you get that right. It's sometimes called substitution, but actually it's just a different focus on the object. The second way is overcoming the bad thoughts by remembering the downsides of the thoughts, remembering how dangerous they are. And it has that beautiful simile of seeing the bad thoughts as having the carcass of a dead dog hanging around your neck. Yeah, that's what bad thoughts are like. Carcass of a, I think the alternatives are carcass of a dead dog, carcass of a dead snake, or carcass of a dead human being. You take your pick. You choose which one you think is most interesting of those. And that is what bad thoughts are like having in your mind. Yeah? It's kind of that how bad it is. The third way is not to pay attention to those bad thoughts. For example, if you're meditating and you just stay with the breath, and you don't really, you just allow those thoughts to, you don't pay attention to them and they kind of gradually disappear as a consequence. The fourth way is to still the sankharas, the volition behind the thoughts. And that is almost like just staying with the thought without feeding it. So the thought is there, but you don't feed it. You just allow it to peter out. And that lack of feeding means that it kind of disappears. It's just being mindful and aware of the thought in a sense. And the last way is to use willpower to press the thought out of your mind. You're pressing your tongue against the roof of your mouth. You clench your teeth together and you force mind with mind. That is kind of the idea there. And that is obviously suppression. And suppression should always be very careful. And that's why it is the last method of those five methods. That's the Vitakka Santana for you in brief. And if you get that right, you will be the master of the thoughts. Could you please tell us some more fun and inspiring stories about Ajahn Brahm? Usually these things kind of come out spontaneously. They're more fun when they come out spontaneously, when you have to kind of... I'll put it over there and we'll see what happens as we move along here. Dear Ajahn, when I have a crush on someone, it is so hard to get rid of. If I tell my mind to stop, it will resist against me. Can you give me some tips on how to overcome this? So the way to overcome these are all of these things are just desires in the sensory realm. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing everywhere. And to remember the downside of these things, that is really the way to overcome this. And remember that all relationships, they end in heartbreak. Yeah, they have to end in heartbreak. Either the relationship is bad, in which case it is bad regardless, or it's going to end in separation. All the relationships end in separation, regardless of what happens. So, in a sense, that is why what we're trying to do on the spiritual path, we're trying to get some of the same emotional qualities in your mind without really attaching yourself to another person. And this is when you practice metta and you practice karuna, compassion and loving kindness. You're actually building up qualities inside that are far more satisfying than the qualities of love that you have for another person, the crush that you have for another person, these kind of things. Far more satisfying and far more fulfilling. And you feel complete within yourself. The idea of falling in love with another person is this feeling that, okay, I only feel complete when I have this other person in my life. But it's possible, and that is very dangerous because it means that you're very vulnerable. That person disappears, they leave you, whatever happens, then you are in trouble. It's going to be very, very painful. But if you can build up those same qualities within yourself, Yeah, and this is kind of what metta and compassion is about. You feel complete within her. And that sense of completion within means that there is no need for external things to fill you up and to make you feel complete. And that is what samadhi is like. Samadhi is a state of completion. And that is why there is no more craving in samadhi, because you feel that you are fulfilled in that state. There's nothing more that needs to be done. There's no search for anything outside. And that's why the five-sense realm comes to an end, because that five-sense realm is the realm where you're searching for things outside. When you feel complete, there's no search anymore. The search has come to a stop. And that is what the spiritual path is about, is finding completion without looking for it on the outside. The sense of completion that you get on the outside through relationships or whatever is never complete anyway. It's only kind of partial. It never really has that final satisfaction. What you get on the spiritual path is the real thing. Absolute, finished completion, fulfillment. So remember the downside and remember the upside of the spiritual path. And then gradually you can get rid of and let go of that crush that you may have. Easy to say, not always easy to do, but gradually over time you should be able to do something with it. All right. Dear Arjan, I'm curious, how did the Buddha-to-be manage to remove his fear and dread when the experiences struck him, whether walking, standing, sitting, etc.? The sutta made it sound so simple. Many thanks and great was that always for your beautiful teachings. Yes, and this is kind of the suttas often just give you the framework. The suttas often give you the bare bones. And they don't actually give you all the meat and all the details that you need to understand fully. And often we have to fill those things in ourselves. So what did he do? One of the things I suggested this afternoon was that he saw the causality. He understood why the fear arises. And you could guess from the way the sutta was phrased that he would have understood that actually what I'm afraid of, I'm just imagining things. You hear a peacock breaking a twig or the wind rustling the leaves. And actually, what am I afraid of? I'm afraid of nothing. I'm afraid of the wind rustling the leaves. That doesn't make any sense. And so it's as simple as that. It's just using your rational mind. And this is why the Buddha says that he is not deluded. This idea of non-delusion precisely comes from that. Seeing the causes for what they are. That is kind of the point here. So it's just understanding things and then letting go through that understanding of things. I think what it really is about. Yes, it seems easy. I think for someone like the Buddha to be, who has many strong spiritual qualities, it can be done. It is not as easy, obviously, for most people. So it's about investigating, understanding, and then letting go as a consequence. I don't know, how do you all feel about walking around in the bush here at night? Would you feel comfortable with that? Just walking around in the bush? I don't know. It's kind of, I'm used to this bush over here, so for me it's kind of second nature to walk around in the bush at night. I do that all the time because I live in a little cootie, and it's very, very safe. It's probably far safer to walk around the bush here than it is to walk around Northridge at night, because that's kind of where people fight and people do all kind of crazy things. There's no one fighting in the bush over here, and that's kind of nuts, except for the kangaroos maybe, but that's okay. So it's all mind-made, it's built up in the mind. It's imagination that things are dangerous usually. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I guess Bodhinyana and Dhammasara do not count as remote lodgings as explained in Majjhima Nikaya 4 discussed today. If overcoming fear is such an important part of the monastic training, how do the monks and nuns achieve it? I think this kind of practice that the Buddha is doing here is not kind of required. It's not part of the curriculum for becoming enlightened or anything like that. The requirement is the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. That is really the requirement. And the main thing is to overcome, to achieve samadhi. That's the main thing here. And there are many ways of achieving samadhi, and it is not necessary. Maybe for some it's necessary, but I think for the majority of people, it's not really required that you confront your fears quite in this way. You will be able to deal with these things in different ways. It will happen kind of naturally through the process. So you basically, what it comes down to is understanding your mind. What are your hindrances? What are your problems? And dealing with those problems. And if you are a person who has to confront your fears, well, then you are that kind of person. But it's not true for everyone. I think it's probably only true for a small minority that they have to practice in this particular way. I think the idea of the sutta is not that everyone has to do exactly what the Buddha did. The sutta is more about inspiring you to take, really not be so fearful, to go for things. You have to try really hard. You really have to test yourself one way or another. It doesn't have to be in this way. It can be sitting long periods of time. It can be just staying by yourself in a kuti. It can be anything, but you need to test yourself and push yourself a little bit. If you are too comfortable, then some often you will not actually make sufficient progress to go all the way to the end of the path. Something like that. It's not to be taken too literally, I think. All right. Dear Ajahn, who is the noble Sangha? Who is the noble Sangha? So noble, in the Buddhist terminology, Arya is the word for noble. And noble is a nice word, isn't it? To be noble, a noble person. There's something very attractive about that. And the noble Sangha are those people who have a direct insight into the teachings of the Buddha. And they are often considered four pairs. They have the stream enterers, once returners, non-returners, and the arahants, the fully awakened ones. And they are different levels of Aryas, the kind of initial insight into the teachings of the Buddha, and then the purification of the mind as a function of that initial insight through various stages. And the reason why these people are noble is because there are many ways of looking at this. One of them is that they are always virtuous, for example. They're always, this is how you can tell whether someone is a noble person. Are they always kind? Do they always live in the, according to these teachings? Are they always practicing the Noble Eightfold Path? And if not always, at least very much so. Sometimes they may make minor mistakes, but then they always confess and they correct it straight away again. So this is the noble Sangha, are those people who have internalized the Noble Eightfold Path, and they practice the Noble Eightfold Path by default. They have no choice but to practice the Noble Eightfold Path, because they have become the Noble Eightfold Path, the Arya Atangika Magga. This is for Yutalata especially, so to get the Pali there. So the Arya Atangika Magga, the Noble Eightfold Path, they have internalized that because they have seen the Dhamma. They understand where happiness is, where suffering is. They understand what is required from a mind to be able to see these things. What kind of mind is able to have these kind of insights? And they know it is the pure mind, the mind without defilements. And so once you understand that there is the mind without defilements, the mind of samadhi that can see this, then the path kind of becomes obvious. You have to do those things that purify the mind. Right actions, right speech, right livelihood, right effort to purify the defilements of the mind. Meditate to eliminate any remaining defilements. It's kind of obvious. Once you understand where you want to be with a purified mind, the path is obvious. The path is that path of purification. As I like to say, the real path of purification is not the work by Buddha Gosa called the Visuddhimagga. The real path of purification is the Arya Atangika Magga, the Noble Eightfold Path. That is the real path of purification. So these are the noble Sangha. So how do you know if someone is a noble person? Well, the answer is you can never really be absolutely sure, but you can have some idea by watching people's conduct. Are they conducting themselves in the right way? Are they generally kind? Are they generous? Are they reasonably peaceful? And all of these kind of things. It gives an idea who are the noble people in the world. And if someone is very angry or they do immoral things, they are greedy or whatever, then there's no way that they are noble ones. That's just not how the noble ones act. And I'm always dismayed when I hear that people find inspiration in people who act immorally. And this happens. I've had monastics who say this to me. They say, oh, this monk in Thailand, he's a really cool monk. Yeah, he just, when he doesn't like you, he kind of just punches you in the face. And I think, what? What are you talking about, punching you in the face? And he must be an arahant because he really gives you a proper punch, right? That's what arahants do. And I think it's crazy. It's completely nuts. And if you believe that kind of thing, you believe anything. Yeah. Someone who is a noble one is someone who is gentle, kind, someone who behaves in the right way. Not crazy wisdom. As I said before, either you're crazy or you're wise. You're not both at the same time. That's impossible. So that's how you know. But even when someone is very kind and they're living in a good way and doing the right thing, you cannot be sure that they are noble ones, because there are many people who are very beautiful people, they have very beautiful characters, but it doesn't mean that they have very profound insight, and they can lose that character again, they can go in the wrong direction. And so you should never be too sure, but where you see consistent good qualities over a long period of time, that is where you can have place some degree of faith and confidence. The noble Sangha. It is more likely to find the noble Sangha among monastics than among lay people. And the reason is because the monastic life is attuned to creating noble people. That's the whole point of it. But sometimes you find very inspiring lay people. I mean, really, really awesome lay people who are far more inspiring than the majority of Sangha, of monastics. So you can find this anywhere. But generally speaking, it is more likely in the monastic Sangha, simply because that's the purpose of that life. All right. So who are they? So you have to decide that for yourself. I'm not going to give you any names what I think, because I might get it wrong, right? No point in me telling you my own delusions. So you have to have your own delusions. Okay, dear Ajahn, has Ajahn Brahm ever shared with you his challenges with meditation? It seems he was already a master meditator from the very beginning. I've heard some masters could give a transmission boost to the disciples with a mere look or touch. Have you heard of such experiences with Ajahn Brahm? I see, you want a shortcut, so that's kind of the kind of electricity just transmits, zap, and you are, yes, sometimes you hear about people who can have this kind of zapping ability, apparently. I've heard more about this in kind of Hindu circles than in Buddhist circles. There are some people who are close, even in Buddhist circles, who do similar kind of things. I think it depends on your personality, whether you're open to being zapped or not. Some people are more zappable than others. So it depends on your zappability. We have to have a scale of zappability, and then we kind of will gauge you, and then we will kind of guide you and see what happens. It is not really very useful. You get some kind of feeling in the presence of somebody, but it doesn't really help you very much apart from that experience. In the end, you have to practice these things, and you have to be able to attain these things through your own means. Otherwise, it's just like in any other experience. It doesn't really kind of go very far. And that's kind of the problems. But has Ajahn Brahm ever shared anything with his challenges in meditation? Yes, he has. It is true that he was a very good meditator from the beginning. And he talks about attaining very deep stages as a layperson before he became a monastic. And he tells these stories about, staring, looking at a flower, looking at a plant for just hours, staring at it because it's so beautiful. He can't kind of get his eyes off that plant. And that's kind of extraordinary. That's pretty amazing. This is the kind of experience that he had when he was a layperson. and going into deep states of samadhi, you know, the all kind of things happening here. He tells a story of watching a wall. He was doing kind of Zen meditation with his eyes open. And then suddenly, as he was kind of staring at this wall, the wall would just melt in front of his eyes and just disappear. And that is kind of, when you attain samadhi with your eyes open, and it's like your sight, sense of sight starts to go funny and even starts to turn off, these are the things that can happen, presumably. That's what happened with him. So he was always a good meditator, but he also had problems in his meditation. And he tells of stories when he was a young monk, when he was overcome by desires in his meditation. So even though he was a very, very skilled meditator, can happen to almost anyone in a meditation. And I think that was probably only for a short period in his life, and then he kind of got over that. But even for Ajahn Brahm, that was a problem. And interestingly, the way he overcame that, he tells the story of how he dealt with that. And he says that whenever he tried to overcome it, and I would try to meditate when all these desires were there, it didn't work. And the desire just kept on coming, and he wasn't really able to let go. And then he said, okay, what I'm going to do, I'm going to set aside 1 hour in the afternoon, I'm going to let the desires just flow naturally, as many desires, all the desires can kind of come. And then when he set aside 1 hour in the afternoon for the desires, there was no desires. It's kind of weird, isn't it? It's interesting because it shows that a lot of it is just the mind being rebellious. The mind wants to do its thing, and once you allow it to do what it wants, the mind is able to let go. So it's kind of fascinating. Sometimes you need to use this counterintuitive psychology to make things work. So even Ajahn Brahm had difficulties in his meditation. It's kind of fascinating, even though he's a very good meditator here. So I think that is all for that one. So let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, I was doing a recollection on generosity, and I thought of Christina Lehar and yourself, among other people, and it brought me a lot of joy. So thank you for that. What a wonderful thing. So that's great. Also, to the people that were asking for the step-by-step instructions to experience jhanas and clairvoyance, you may like to point them to the gradual training. It's among my favorite teachings, absolutely. Many thanks to everyone that makes these retreats possible. You are all awesome. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's what it says here. I'm just reading here. So, that's wonderful that you're doing that kind of recollection of generosity. There's so much goodness going around in a community like this, and when you just seeing that goodness can make you joyful. So that is a wonderful reminder. And yes, indeed, the gradual training is a very important teaching, and I very often actually read that out on these retreats. One of the best explanations of the gradual training is found in Majjhima Nikaya number 27, middling sayings number 27. It's called the Chula Hatti Padopama Sutta, the shorter sutta on the elephant's footprint. And that is the sutta that was spoken by Mahinda when he went to Sri Lanka. When Buddhism came to Sri Lanka, Mahinda was the son of the Emperor Ashoka, and he sent his son Mahinda and his daughter Sangamitta to Sri Lanka, and they went to Sri Lanka, and the sutta that he taught the king of Sri Lanka and his court, the royal entourage, was this particular sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 27, the shorter sutta on the elephant's footprint, Chula Hatti Padopama Sutta. And that was what kind of made Sri Lanka Buddhist, because the king was convinced, and his entourage, many of them became stream entries, according to the story, I think. It's all found in some of these history books, the Mahavamsa and all of that. So that is, for that reason, it's actually a very famous sutta, especially in Sri Lanka. That is what Poson Day is about, isn't it? That Poson, when Buddhism came to Sri Lanka, that's kind of the special Sri Lankan celebration, Buddhist celebration. And it's not only does it have the gradual training, which in its own right is very beautiful, very interesting, and it gives you a very clear step-by-step guide how to go all the way to awakening, but it also has this beautiful simile of the elephant's footprint. And just like when you see a footprint in the forest, and you know it is an elephant's footprint, you see, but you don't know that it is a large elephant until you actually see the elephant with your eyes. From the footprint, you can only guess, probably is a large elephant, but you can't be 100% sure until you see it. And the simile says that some of the states of meditation that you attain before awakening, like the jhanas are the footprints of the Buddha. Yeah, in other words, you know the Buddha must have been here. Yeah, you see the footprints of the Buddha. This is the sort of thing the Buddha would do. He would do jhanas. In other words, this is how you know. And so that's kind of extraordinary. One of the things that never stops me to amaze me, the way that the jhanas and samadhi is praised in the suttas, how highly it is elevated. Yeah, the footsteps of the Buddha, for goodness sake. Yeah, that's kind of extraordinary. Yeah. And that means that jhana is not some kind of state where you're just kind of thinking a little bit, you got a bit of happiness. It means it's something extraordinary here. It means it is some kind of superhuman quality, as it says elsewhere here. And this is these are very important things that often are not really pointed out enough, I think. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for that. All right. What is original mind? Who believes in it? Who doesn't? And why should we care? Thank you. All right. What is original mind? Actually, I don't even know what original mind is, to be honest with you. And it seems to be one of these words and expression that is used differently by different people. It basically doesn't seem to be very clear what it means. Original mind is an expression used sometimes in Thailand by certain teachers. And I know Ajahn Chah was asked, what is original mind? And he said, he just didn't know what to say. And he said, well, apparently said something to the effect that, well, if original mind, if you have something here and you remove it, and what is left is original mind, you can call that original mind if you like. But there's like nothing left if you remove something here. If you want to call it original, that's up to you. But that was his explanation of original mind. In other words, it's nothing. Yeah, it's something is gone. That is one way of thinking about it. But another way of thinking about this whole idea, and this is where we get more into kind of the deeper aspects of the Dhamma. What is Nibbana? What is the end point of the Buddhist path? This is where things get very tricky and very difficult. Because once you start to talk about the end point of the Buddhist path, it is very hard, because we are all coming from a sense of self. And if you come from a sense of self, it is essentially impossible to understand the end point of the Buddhist path and really appreciate it. So it is very common in Buddhist circles to understand the end of the Buddhist path as some kind of eternal mind. And if that is what is meant by original mind, then there is a problem. An eternal mind or an eternal consciousness. And the Buddha calls that eternalism. And it's one of the things that he actually rejects. And even though the Buddha makes this, to my mind, very, very clear in the suttas, still the desire for some kind of eternal life, inclination of the mind to carry on, to live forever, whatever, is so strong that you tend to read the suttas through those biased ideas, and then you see eternalism, where in fact there is no such thing in the suttas. So that is the problem, right? Who believes in it? Well, you just have to listen to Dhamma talks and you will find out very quickly who believes in these things. And you will listen to Dhamma talks, find out who doesn't believe in these things. And the reason you should care is because one of these is the path to the end of suffering, the other one is not. That's why you should care. If you believe in eternalism and you hold on to something as eternal, you're not going to make an end of suffering. That is the issue. So actually, it actually matters quite enormously as far as the Buddhist path is concerned. All right, I will leave it at that because it is an interesting and important topic, but also quite profound. Dear Ajahn, some of the Perth-based meditators may find it interesting to know that the BSWA organizes a full day 8 precept program at Dhammaloka on the Thursday closest to every full moon day. Thank you. All right. That's wonderful. I wasn't even quite aware of that myself, to be honest with you. So that's kind of really, really nice. So full day 8 precept program at Dhammaloka on the Thursday closest to every full moon day. Okay. Excellent. And that means that you can kind of carry on with your meditation there on Thursdays closest to the full moon. Okay, good. So there you are. Dear Ajahn, I was in Thailand recently and participated in the morning merit-making when monks walked along the seashore to receive alms. Instead of fresh food, the hotel prepared a merit package consisting of rice grains, a bottle of sugar, and some packaged candy, chocolate. I thought monks are not allowed to cook their own food. Why the rice then? I suspect that what is happening here is that this is just a ceremonial thing. It is not actually, the rice is probably not really meant for the monks to eat, at least not straight away. And it probably just gets given to them and then they pass it on to some lay people. And then the lay people do whatever they want with it. And maybe it comes back to the monks, maybe it doesn't. Something like that. I think this is more like a ritual. It's a kind of ceremonial merit-making rather than a real alms offering. That would be my guess. But I cannot be entirely sure, of course. That would be my guess of what is happening here. All right. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I have aroused interest in studying and reading the suttas in the Nikayas and wish I could understand them correctly and practice accordingly. Thanks to you. Is there a way to go about deepening into the Nikayas in a systematic way? As a beginner, how do we start? What do we start with? In the past, I have randomly read the suttas at random times, and this did not bring much impression as it was random. Appreciate your advice. Thank you. One way of doing this is to listen to the sutta discussions that we have at the Dhammaloka Center. We do this on Sundays, the second and the fourth Sunday of the month. We have a sutta class, and that is a good way of learning the suttas properly, because you go into quite a bit of detail and explain what is going on. It's a bit like this retreat, but a particular sutta is chosen. Another way that I would recommend you, there is a whole series now of early Buddhist teachings on the BSWA website, where we discuss various aspects of Buddhism from the point of view of early Buddhism. And so, for example, there is an introductory part there which just talks about early Buddhism in general, what is meant by early Buddhist text, how to differentiate an early Buddhist text from later Buddhist text, what is likely to have been the word of the Buddha, what is not likely to have been the word of the Buddha. And this is kind of what we discuss in the first of this series. Then we talk about karma and rebirth in the context of the early Buddhist text. It's a very interesting topic. Lots of strange ideas in the Buddhist world about karma and rebirth. I can tell you that straight away. And it's quite interesting to listen to that. Then we have dependent origination, from the point of view of the early Buddhist text. Then we have the Noble Eightfold Path from the point of view of the early Buddhist text. And in fact, we're going to start, as soon as this 9-day retreat is over, the next week and after that, we're starting a course at Dhammaloka on the factor 9 and 10 of the Noble Eightfold Path. I was testing you, see if you got that one. So this is the tenfold path, right? The tenfold path is an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path. And so you have factor 9 and 10. And that's the right knowledge and right liberation that comes about as a function of practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. So that will start on Saturday week. Yeah, that is over 4 Saturdays. And it will be Venerable Sunyo and myself, and also Bhante Sujata will also come for a couple of weekends, a couple of Saturdays. So it'll be very interesting and exciting class. So all of that is available online. And it goes into some depth about what the Buddha meant by these things. And I would say it is very, to my mind, it's very interesting. I'm the one who's said a lot of that stuff, so it better be interesting from my point of view. So that is a good place to start. And then you can read things like In the Buddha's Words by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, where he translates and he has introductions and notes, etc. It's a very nice little book. It is an anthology of suttas, and the suttas are grouped according to categories, according to themes. It's a thematic kind of approach. In the Buddha's Words, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's a book that you can also borrow at the library at Dhammaloka Center if you like. So that's kind of how I would start, gradually kind of getting into it. And then you can eventually just take the Majjhima Nikaya, the middling sayings of the Buddha, and you can just start and read from page 1. No, not from page 1, more like from page 2. What I mean is that the very first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya is very profound, and so skip the first one, go to the second sutta first of all, start with that one. If you don't like the second one, go to the third one, etc., etc. Do what you enjoy, basically. That's kind of the best way of reading the suttas. But the Majjhima Nikaya is a beautiful collection because they are complete suttas. They are not just kind of short little things that kind of give you a very specific topic that is discussed, but they are complete. You see the Buddha in discussion with somebody. You see how he persuades people. It gives you a feeling for what is going on. And it gives you a feeling which is much broader than just a very technical topic being discussed. And so they're very nice suttas because of their very rounded and very complete. Anyway, so I hope that helps. Okay. Next one. Dear Ajahn, why do we pray or share transfer merit to the dead? If they have been reborn to another being, who are we actually sharing merits with? Thank you for all your teachings. Well, first of all, we don't really pray, right? In Buddhism, we do anjali. Anjali is not praying. People think that this is praying. Nothing to do with praying. There's no one to pray to. So how can you pray when there's no one to pray to? We're not praying to the Buddha. Buddha, please help me, help me. The Buddha is dead. He can't help you. Yeah, it's finished. There's nothing that you have to help yourself. That is the problem in Buddhism. So this here is really just a sign of respect. Yeah, this is a respect towards the Buddha or respect for each other. It can be mutual respect between people of equal standing. So this is kind of standard way of showing respect for others in Buddhism. It is not praying, even though many people seem to think that's what it is. And then we have the idea of sharing and transferring merit to the dead. The idea is that if you have been born in a certain way, you can receive the kindness of other people, especially your family members, when you have been reborn in a bad state. So you share the merit with them. Yeah, you say, I'm giving this, doing this act of generosity in your name. And maybe they will be able to feel that. Yeah, maybe they will say, wow, look at my daughter, my son, they're doing something for me. Wow, that is so nice. Yeah, and you feel so good in your heart because your children are doing something for you. Parents are very close to their children. And so for a parent, that is very, very heartwarming. Yeah, and very beautiful when they see your child doing something for you. And so at that moment, you may feel a sense of joy and happiness. And this is called transferring merit, when they rejoice in the fact that you are kind towards them. And then that can actually get them reborn straight away out of that state of difficulty. Yeah, if you are reborn in the Petaloka, the ghost realm, it is not very nice. And if you can help your family members to get out of that, what a wonderful thing that is. So in the future, whenever you do an act of generosity or kindness or whatever, always dedicate that merit to your deceased relatives. What if you don't have any relatives in the Petaloka? What happens then? That's an interesting question, right? What if you try to dedicate merit to your family members in the Petaloka, in the ghost realm, but there's no one there? What happens? Is it wasted? How do we know? How many relatives do we have anyway in the Petaloka? It's all a bit uncertain, isn't it? But the Buddha comes to the rescue. The Buddha says that regardless, we have been wandering around the samsaric existence for so long, it is guaranteed that you will have at least some relatives in that Petaloka. Guaranteed. Yeah, so it is never wasted. Whenever you share some merit, someone there will be able to receive it, because we have so many relatives in all kinds of realms everywhere. And it's kind of one of those beautiful reflections in Buddhism, is the reflection that almost any being in the world has been our mother, our father, our son, our daughter, our brother, our sister, almost any being. So when you look at people around you in the world, think of them in that way. This has been maybe my son or my daughter in a past life. And when someone is your son and your daughter, you start thinking about them in a very different way. You become more accepting. You become more compassionate and loving, because that's what happens when you have sons and daughters. So actually all of these things are very nice ways of thinking about things in a different way. And the same thing with the Petaloka and the merit. Okay, we're running a little bit out of time, so I think you're right, Robin. I may have to leave some for tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, when doing daily activities, washing dishes, walking, etc., what is the way to stay mindful? Is it the same as when meditating and you don't force the attention on the task, or use effort to keep the mind on the task and don't allow it to wander? Thank you. The first thing here is to ask yourself, when you want to stay mindful, why do you want to stay mindful with the daily tasks? And this is a very important question. And the reason why it is such an important question is that it seems to be assumed in Buddhist circles that just being mindful for mindfulness's sake is a good thing. Is a positive thing. We should always be mindful, right? This is what you hear again and again in Buddhist circles. And there are some reasons why this is being said. I won't go too much into those reasons. But the point of being mindful is not just being mindful for mindfulness's sake. The idea seems to be that if you are mindful in daily activities, then when you go and meditate, you will be mindful and meditation happens automatically. The idea seems to be that mindfulness leads to mindfulness. But actually, the Buddha doesn't say that anywhere. He doesn't say mindfulness leads to mindfulness. He says sila and right view lead to mindfulness. That is what matters. And that gives you the idea why you should be mindful. The reason you should be mindful is because it helps you to live well. It helps you to live morally. You are more aware of what is happening in your mind. You're more aware of what's coming out of your mouth. Like Ajahn Brahm likes to say, it's more important what comes out of your mouth than what you put into your mouth, right? Usually we think it's more important what we put into our mouth, and actually that's not so important at all. What comes out, that is what really matters. And so you are more aware of your state of mind and everything that you do. That is the purpose of mindfulness. So it's not just about being aware in daily activities. It is about being aware of how you are, where your mind is at, what is happening with you, whether you are pure, whether you're thinking in the right way, whether you're getting ill will, whether you're getting all of these desires. That is what really matters. And if you are aware of that, you can take countermeasures using some of the techniques that we talk about here, learning how to think differently. That is the important point. So we need to get away from this idea that it's just about being mindful in daily activities, because it doesn't really do very much. It is a specific purpose to be aware of what is happening in your mind. That is what is important. So what you do then is that you learn the importance, the significance of being virtuous, of living well. The more you understand the importance of that, the more naturally your mind, your mindfulness will be aware of what you are thinking and what you are doing. Yeah, it comes because you understand the importance of it. Right? It's like if you come to a road, right, you know the importance of looking left and right. You're not just going to walk into the road, yeah, because you know you're going to be dead if you do that very soon. So you know, you are mindful, it's kind of lodged so strongly in the back of your mind that when you come to the curb of a road, you always look left, you always look right before you cross. If you didn't do that, you wouldn't be here anymore. Yeah? And so it's exactly the same thing with virtue. The virtue is so important to you. It's like you're crossing a road, right? In fact, it is far more important. If you cross the road and the car comes, the worst thing that can happen is that you die. It's not such a big deal if you die, right? What is really bad is if you live in the wrong way and you get a bad rebirth. That is the really big problem. Or you waste the opportunity to practice the spiritual path. That is the real issue. Death in Buddhism is not such a big issue. How we live our lives, that is the real issue. So when you come to the curb of your mind and you're about to think the wrong thing or whatever, yeah, you stop and you ask yourself, how can I think something different? Because you know this is so important. And this is the idea. So you need to lodge this in your mind to understand how incredibly important these things are. And then you will have that awareness there, always checking what you're doing. And this is what you should do during your daily activities. Yeah, when you're washing the dishes or whatever you're doing, this is what you should be. This is what should be the kind of the main thing to focus on, if you like. And you, how do you do that? You do it from right view, understanding how significant it is. That's how it happens. All right. So there you are. Okay. Were at some times lay people included as Sangha? So in other words, are lay people included as Sangha? The answer is that previously not, but now it seems more and more yes. So in the good old days, and this is now we really are talking about the good old days, the traditional way, Buddhist way of thinking about Sangha. Sangha is always, by definition, monastics. That is how, that's just the word for the monastic group. They were called Sangha in ancient India. These days, especially in the United States, they use the word Sangha to mean any group of people practicing Buddhist path together. They call them Sangha. Yeah, and that is it's kind of a new way of using that word, which you don't actually find in the suttas. So Sangha just means like monastic order. If you say monastic order, are lay people ever included in the monastic order? It doesn't make any sense, right? It's kind of, it's like saying, it's a bit like saying lay people are included in Sangha. So, yeah. Okay, let me do one more question. And then we shall call it a night. Dear Ajahn, I read in the suttas that there were beings such as Maras, Nagas, Yakka, etc. Which realm do they belong to? So these beings that you're talking about here, these are like invisible beings. And they, Mara, here is, Mara is a being that belongs to actually a very high heavenly realm. Surprise, surprise, all the way to the very top of the sensory realm. The sensory realm, the sensory heavenly realms go very high, and Mara is in the highest one of these. It's called the Paranimitta Vasavati realm. It means the Paranimitta Vasavati means those who wield powers over the creations of others. That's kind of literally what it means. And so Mara is kind of a powerful deity that wields power over other people's creations, etc. So that's Mara. So Mara is very powerful because it belongs to a very high realm. The Nagas and Yakkas are said to belong to the Maha Chaturajika realm. Yeah, the four great kings. This is supposedly the lowest of the heavenly realms. Yeah, kind of one realm above the human realm, and that is where these are presumably meant to be, these kind of beings. Do these beings actually exist? And I would say, yes, they do exist. You know, one of the interesting things about Nagas, I translate the word Naga as dragon. It can also be translated as snake or serpent. But they have certain dragon aspects to them. For example, they can be fire-breathing. Fire-breathing is a dragon in Western vocabulary, not really a snake. If you look around the world and you look at the various mythologies around the world and the legends, almost all the world, the cultures have legends and mythology with dragons in them. Yeah, it's everywhere. Found in China, certainly is very famous for its dragons, but also India, European culture has dragons. Yeah, they're found everywhere. And so sometimes the interesting question is, how come that these things exist in all the various cultures? And one answer for that is because, this is one possible answer anyway, because everyone is kind of seeing some underlying truth. Sometimes we have a vision of some underlying reality. And because all cultures, there will be sometimes be people who see deeper into things. That may be why these things exist in all cultures. The Yakkas are also in that realm, and sometimes they are good Yakkas, sometimes they are bad Yakkas. There are Buddhist Yakkas, and there are non-Buddhist Yakkas. Yeah, so if you're going to be reborn as a Yakka, make sure you are a Buddhist Yakka. So again, you are more powerful than ordinary, and you get reborn in the heavenly realm, and you are these beings. And sometimes they are a bit of a menace, and other times they are kind of kind and living a good and virtuous life. And one of the interesting things that Ajahn Brahm mentioned this before. I think Ajahn Brahm once gave a talk on UFOs. Sometimes people do see all of these kind of strange things in the world, lights and that kind of stuff. What are those things? One of the problems that you find in the suttas they often talk about, lights and these devas appearing as lights. And then the question is, well, how come we don't see them these days? And maybe we do. Maybe we do see them. It's just that we don't recognize them. Maybe things like UFOs or whatever, maybe they really are devas. Maybe they are yakkas. People having some kind of interaction with these beings. Maybe. Maybe not. Uncertain. Okay. So I'm going to stop there for tonight. As always, I wish you a marvelous night. May you have a nice and good rest. And then we will see you again tomorrow morning. Let's just end up, as usual, paying respect to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.